You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
Today's passage is an excerpt from one of several judgment scenes crowded into what's called Jesus' Final Discourse series in Matthew. The scribes and Pharisees have just been denounced for their rejection of the Messiah and warned of their ultimate punishment. Then come the examples of the faithful and unfaithful servants, those who have broken trust with their master, and those who have been faithful in their service. And here's the big takeaway that is often overlooked. The deciding factor in determining the fate of the judged is the good or evil done to the least of these. Basically, any and all who suffer the hardships listed in the text: hunger, thirst, nakedness, sickness, homelessness, imprisonment. What is not a consideration at all? Belief. What one believes is a total non-issue. What matters is action, an action on behalf of and with those the culture ignores or leaves behind. As Jesus begins the parable, he uses an image that would have been common to first century folk. At the close of the day, shepherds could be seen separating the sheep and the goats. The hardy sheep would graze through the night outside in the chilly air, and the more fragile goats would be sheltered from the weather. We'll skip the observation that sheep tend to be dumb as fence posts, and goats are pretty smart. So, in the image of the shepherd separating the sheep from the goats, Matthew sets up a crisis moment for people to wonder, hang on, which one am I? How do I get the good seats at this banquet? Jesus makes it pretty clear. When we serve our needy neighbor, hungry, thirsty, in prison, we're doing exactly what Jesus expects. Truly, I tell you, Jesus says, just as you did it to one of the least of these who are members of my family, you did it to me.
Our words of wisdom today are from Matthew chapter 25, verses 35 and 36. For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, and you welcomed me. I was naked, and you gave me clothing. I was sick, and you took care of me. I was in prison, and you visited me. Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
In Paul's first letter to the Corinthians, you'll find one of the most oft-quoted and watered-down New Testament passages, most often heard at weddings. Love is patient and kind. Love doesn't envy or boast. It isn't arrogant or rude. It doesn't insist on its own way. It's not irritable or resentful. It doesn't rejoice at wrongdoing, but rejoices with the truth. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never ends. Now, those sentiments are all fine and good at weddings, but fine-tuning the relationship between two people in love is not what the author had in mind. It's hard for most people to grasp, but the idea of agape, the Greek word used in this passage, is about the call to show unconditional care, goodwill, and benevolence toward everyone. Sure, there are other words for love in Greek, eros for erotic love, and philia for a more cordial, philanthropic love. But the real challenge is acknowledging and living out this radical idea about a love that Jesus taught and modeled, a kind of love that represents the highest, deepest, and most powerful force in human life, that fosters human growth and change. That's the impulse behind empathy and concern that drives compassion and the longing for justice. And that's where it's impossible for many people to make the jump from the sentimental, spiritualized version of love promoted by the gospel about Jesus to the radical and dangerous implications of the kind of love actually practiced by Jesus. As a good Jew, Jesus would have probably known Leviticus 19:18 by heart. Love your neighbor as yourself. As one of my mentors, Rabbi Rami Shapiro, points out, a lot of people today get this passage completely wrong. They quote it as, love your neighbor as you love yourself. No! People say, well, I have to work on loving myself before I can love my neighbor. No, that's not what the passage says. It says, love your neighbor as yourself, not as you love yourself, as yourself, as though they are a part of you, integrated, connected, and one with one another. This means all our neighbors, without regard to race, color, religion, sexual orientation, gender identity, or national origin. They are an extension of you. And sometimes that can be a tough barrier to break down. A couple of weeks ago, I mentioned Clarence Jordan's pioneering work in the civil rights movement of the 50s and 60s. The Southern Baptist pastor and scholar Dr. Jordan started Koinonia Farm, an interracial farming community in Georgia. He'd often be invited to be the guest preacher in little Baptist churches, and because of his message of equality for all people of all colors, he'd usually not get invited back. And on one occasion, he gave a sermon that called for the United States to stop the practice of segregation. After the service, a lady came up to him and was indignant. My granddaddy was an officer in the Confederate Army, and he would not believe a word that you just said about race relations. Sorry. Dr. Jordan smiled sweetly and said, well, ma'am, your choice is very clear then. You can follow your granddaddy, or you can follow Jesus. Clarence Jordan was a lot like Jesus. He was willing to let people hear the hard demands of his message and to let them walk away. They found his words too troubling or offensive. So did Jesus. So should we. Whenever you're promoting a conspiracy, some people are just going to back away slowly and say, no, thank you. The sad part about Jesus' conspiracy of love is that most Christians have said, no, thank you. Most churches have made participation or acceptance in the kingdom about being a part of the in crowd, believing the right stuff, and rejecting the unclean people the church tells you to hate. That's the gospel about Jesus. The gospel of Jesus, the message of the Malkutha of God, the conspiracy of love, is 180 degrees in opposition to that mindset. In fact, our conspiratorial guide, Kurt Struckmeyer, writes, I don't believe that one even has to be a Christian to be engaged in the work of the conspiracy of God. The peasants Jesus interacted with in Galilee, Judea, and Samaria were not Christians, and they were the first ones called into the conspiracy. Christianity wasn't even a glimmer on the horizon, but it didn't matter, because at the core of what Jesus taught and modeled was a very Jewish concept that anybody can embrace, of any religion or no religion. Tikkun Olam, meaning the repairing or healing of the world, suggests that all human beings have a shared responsibility to transform the world through social action in the pursuit of social justice. This is not a task just for people of faith, let alone a particular faith, or any faith at all. It's the responsibility of all people everywhere. And if Christianity has any relevant role in contemporary society, it's to bear witness to and point people towards this unifying collective reality. And here's the kicker. As long as the church refuses to respond to the radical demands of love's conspiracy, if it continues to lay down belief and behavior requirements for membership in the kingdom, If it continues to mislead people to believe that Jesus' primary message was about himself, then guess what? The conspiracy of love will just get along without the church. Thank you very much. Theologian Harvey Cox, famous for being both one of the most influential theologians of the 20th century and having played saxophone at the Fountains, points out that people from all sorts of backgrounds and faiths find Jesus to be both fascinating and admirable. Jesus was profoundly courageous in showing compassion for the disinherited and standing up to corrupt political and religious authorities. But even more than that is Jesus' message of hope for a better world, that communities of love and reciprocity, forgiveness and compassion are within our grasp, even if they cannot be fully realized. And to be part of this conspiracy of love, one not only doesn't have to be a part of a religious group, one doesn't even have to believe in the traditional idea of a supernatural God. The author of 1 John certainly didn't. In chapter 4, the writer contends that God is love, and those who abide in love abide in God, and God abides in them. Wait, what? In the original Greek, God is love is teos ein agape. There's that agape again, a sense of selfless, unconditional love. When the author of 1 John writes that God is love, then it stands to reason that the converse also must be true. Love is God. So the word God, even the idea of God, can be said to be a personification of love. Are you with me? For countless thousands of years, humanity has been fixated on trying to project its ideas about God onto a meddling, interventionist, supernatural, divine entity, when according to the Bible itself, God is not a loving being. God is love itself. To say that love is God means we no longer have to argue about the nature of God being a transcendent supernatural deity beyond the clouds or an impersonal creative reality woven throughout creation itself. God is instead an immanent reality within each of us, longing to be expressed in our own transformation and the transformation of the world. Love is bound up in and dependent on humanity and manifested in what we talked about before as incarnation. Remember, incarne equals with meat, like chili con carne, right? So a lot of people have worked to derail the idea that we are incarnations of the divine in favor of emphasizing exclusively that Jesus is the uniquely incarnate one. But the message of the New Testament, the message of the mystics, and the heart of this conspiracy of love all embrace the idea that the divine has come to dwell among us, not just in the person of Jesus, but in every human being. Indeed, just the way the divine has always been, deeply and unalterably a part of every person. So the good news is that even if you don't believe in the traditional idea of a theistic God above the heavens, there's no problem. You can still affirm and live by the power of love as a dynamic and transformative force in the world. Love changes people. Love changes societies. And in the final analysis, isn't that what Jesus was on about? If you haven't heard me say it clearly enough yet, let me say it one more time. It makes no difference if God is real or metaphor. Acts of unconditional, selfless love is the stuff of what most people would recognize as holy, divine, or worth giving one's life for. Let me ask you this question. If you could sit down and have a beer with Jesus, although he'd probably order the wine, would you ask this question for me? Jesus, would you rather that I believe a bunch of stuff about you that was made up by your followers? Or would you rather me just ignore all that stuff and do what you taught? I think I know what he'd say. I think you do too. And that's what makes this conspiracy so threatening to the status quo. It's a conspiracy of love, of action, of transformation, all of which can be accomplished without the help of Christians or a church caught up in misleading and outdated liturgy, doctrines, and dogma. So in the end, Jesus' whole program, this kingdom, this Malkutha, this conspiracy is not about Christianity. It's not about church and not about belief. It's about acts of love. John Caputo writes, "Where is it found? It's found every time an offense is forgiven, every time a stranger is made welcome, every time an enemy is embraced, every time the least of us is lifted up, every time the law is made to serve justice, every time a prophetic voice is raised against injustice, every time the law and the prophets are summed up by love." Sounds like our passage today, doesn't it? "For I was hungry and you gave me food. I was thirsty and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger and you welcomed me. I was naked and you gave me clothing. I was sick and you took care of me. I was in prison and you visited me." This conspiracy of love, initiated by Jesus, calls people, not just Christians, not people of faith, just people, to be compassionate instruments of goodwill, engaged in transforming themselves, their families, their communities, their nations, and the world. This is not just a Christian pursuit, but the task of all humanity working together. And Kurt Struckmeyer believes that this vision of Jesus can best be described in the words of philosopher Charles Eisenstein as, "That more beautiful world our hearts know is possible." Okay, so we know a more beautiful world is possible. But who's going to make it happen? Look at who Jesus called. Not powerful, influential people. Peasants, laborers, untouchables, foreigners, and don't be shocked, women. He didn't ask people to sign on to a bunch of beliefs or commit to particular spiritual practices. He offered them a vision where acts of selfless love and compassion worked over time to transform indifference, greed, exclusion, violence, and selfishness into that better world our hearts know is possible. The essence of following Jesus? Seemingly insignificant actions by countless ordinary people that over time transform the world. If you follow politics at all, you probably know of New Jersey Senator Cory Booker, former mayor of Newark. What you might not know is that Booker went to Stanford University, where he played football on scholarship. He earned a bachelor's degree in political science and a master's degree in sociology. Then, as a Rhodes Scholar at Queen's College, Oxford, he earned an honors degree in U.S. history. Only then did he go on to Yale to earn a law degree. While speaking to Stanford's graduating class of 2012, he told the students that his achievements in life were only possible because of a vast conspiracy of love. Countless acts by countless people who laid the groundwork for his achievements. Booker said that at his own graduation, his father, Kerry, took him aside and said, "You need to understand that who you are now, you are the physical manifestation of a conspiracy of love. That people whose names you don't even know, who struggled for you, who fought for you, who sweated for you, who volunteered for you, you are here because of them. Don't you forget that." And if I sit down and start taking into account all the ways that's true for me, I soon get overwhelmed with feelings of gratitude, humility, and grace. I remember back in graduate school in Boston, my tuition and many other expenses were covered by scholarship, but living expenses were often pretty tight. And on several occasions, when I was down to my last few dollars, I remember getting a check in the mail from a loosely organized group of former missionaries here in Arizona who took up a collection out of their meager resources and sent $200 here, $100 there to support various students they knew of around the world. And I will tell you, when you're down to a few dollars in a city like Boston, a $100 check was a huge relief. Now, I knew who was the ringleader of this group, but he would never reveal who the other contributors were. Part of their MO was that the donations were anonymous. It was like, I don't know, a conspiracy. Despite our very mixed reputation throughout history, many Christians have nevertheless been a powerful force for human equality, for compassion, for justice, love, and a belief in the sacredness of every human life. But it doesn't happen on its own. It doesn't happen just because you believe the right stuff. It's because in certain times and certain places, people felt the call to love welling up inside, and they just plain couldn't help themselves. They took the risk to make that beautiful world they knew was possible a reality. Senator Booker's dad said to him, "You have a choice in life. You can just sit back, getting fat, dumb, and happy, consuming all the blessings put before you, or it can metabolize inside of you, become fuel to get you into the fight, to make this democracy real, to make it true to its words, that we can be a nation of liberty and justice for all." Nation, world, neighborhood, or wherever, we have a choice. And who we are as just regular folk is not a disadvantage. It's just the kind of camouflage a good conspiracy thrives on. I know that not everyone is a Lord of the Rings goober, but author J.R.R. Tolkien was a devout Roman Catholic. And even for the uninitiated, there are lots of familiar Christian themes surfacing throughout the whole series. In the movie The Hobbit, An Unexpected Journey, there's a scene where two of the main characters, Lady Galadriel and Gandalf the Wizard, are discussing the titular character, Bilbo Baggins, who's a hobbit. Bilbo, the halfling, is a comfortable, insignificant, middle-aged hobbit chosen by Gandalf to go on a dangerous, seemingly impossible quest, and Lady Galadriel is curious about his choice.
Mithrandir.
Why the halfling?
I do not know. Saruman believes that it is only a great power that can hold evil in check. But that is not what I have found. I found it is the small things, everyday deeds of ordinary folk that keeps the darkness at bay. Simple acts of kindness and love. Why Bilbo Baggins? Perhaps it is because I'm afraid. And it gives me courage.
The great and powerful wizard, given courage by the insignificant middle-aged nobody of Bilbo Baggins. Yep, because that's the way the world works. You'll remember Margaret Mead's great observation. Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has. So, are you going to join the conspiracy? Are you going to love with all your heart? Are you going to take the chances it will sometimes take to make the changes that your heart is calling you to make, personally, in your neighborhood, in the big bad world? A more beautiful world is possible. Your heart knows it's true, but there are a lot of obstacles between us and making it real. Disinformation, pushback, hatred, fear, and selfishness. But Jesus has shown us the way. Not an easy way of overnight success, but the work of a lifetime, of many lifetimes, all working together to further Jesus' conspiracy of love. Here's to putting love first in all we do. Be well.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information or to support this outreach with a donation, visit www.weputlovefirst.org.